Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA. Christmas time is here, by golly. And I want to tell you that Margaret Johnson indeed has made a name for herself over a long period now. Because this is this your ninth book that we are drawing attention to, again, because of Christmas? Is this 9 or 10?
It's actually 10, but ninth Irish. I took a little break for a very short period of time and wrote an afternoon tea cookbook. It still had quite a few Irish recipes and places for tea in Dublin and thereabouts, but officially it was not an Irish cookbook.
How about that? Okay, well now, how possibly do you get to, and you know, this is not a pamphlet. This is this is a nice thick a book of 180 or so pages. How do you get and keep up with recipes not only conflicting with your own previously written, but considering that all of the cookbooks that are out there, how do you keep track of these?
Well, I have a great filing system, number one. You know, I try not to repeat recipes, but occasionally I do if they're appropriate.
Yeah.
For example, I wrote a book called Puddings, Tarts, Crumbles, and Fools, which was an all Irish desserts cookbook. But I had a fifth chapter just on Irish Christmas cookery.
Yeah.
So obviously a lot of those recipes are repeated in this. But I go back to Ireland 2-3 times a year, try to meet new people, and every time I go back to Ireland, there is some new producer. There's some new person making cheese or making oat cakes or something wonderful, because there's so many wonderful things happening in the food world in Ireland. So it's not that hard to come up with new ideas, actually.
You know, it's we wouldn't have to go back too many decades, indeed, for those who would indeed sneer as if one were to say Ireland is indeed becoming a, you know, the culinary destination of Europe. Let's say, what are you talking about?
They still say it, Adrian, and they still sneer. It's a hard sell.
It is a hard sell. But, okay, so what is different? And you've been a writer of cookbooks, and not just cookbooks, but articles for Becca's as we can remember, and it shows up everywhere, in and out of Irish circles. But what is it that makes it, you know, so hard to understand that actually, you know, now we would recognize that there are great restaurants in Ireland and that they're, you know, but that's fairly recent.
It is. The hardest people to convince are those who have never been to Ireland, and who perhaps had Irish ancestors, whose cooking was more like my grandparents and maybe yours, or maybe even your parents. You know, simple, a roast, you know, potatoes, vegetables, stews, etc.
Yeah,
and a lot of people who have never traveled to Ireland still have only that concept in their heads.
And
they don't
Ireland,
want to get rid of it. They don't want to lose it.
And Ireland has been, you know, the butt of such derogatory, you know, jokes when it comes to food. Ones that we've heard over and over again, tongue in cheek, as if it were just created as the, you know, seven-course Irish meal is the six-pack and the boiled potato.
Correct.
But that's about as accurate as they, you know, as the plastic shamrocks and the plastic hats rolled out for St. Patrick's Day. But, you know, there's great emphasis now on organic foods, and yes. that also is
gluten-free.
Yeah, which of course we didn't even know what that was a few short years ago. What is it, say, about cooking and ingredients that you use? Are there some taboo, well-known ingredients that have surfaced that some journal of medicine has said, wait a minute, you know.
Don't eat that.
Don't eat that. Where does that figure
I don't know. I mean, of course, people always talk about the Irish that they hate so much butter, they eat so many, you know,
right.
sausages, and they eat things.
And salt.
Like this. And
yeah.
salt, right, right. I mean, I don't know. They've been, some people, you know, they have ancestors who are 99 years old and they're doing perfectly well. I think everything, I had a good friend who was a French physician, and he said, everything in moderation. And that was, I think those are words to live by. Regardless of whether you're Italian or Irish or German, you know,
sure.
you can't keep eating, you can't eat sausages all day and you can't eat butter on everything. But,
right.
I mean, there's a certain reasonableness to what people eat. And I think that has to just hold true for everybody.
Do you, when you are writing books, and particularly again, let's say, you must hold the record on books on Irish and Irish cooking and Irish flavors but is there a point where you say, boy, I better buy one or I better write a book on gluten-free? Or for that matter, on, you know, the diet, a diet book on desserts or something. Is there?
No.
No.
Never.
Okay.
No. A friend of mine did suggest that I write a book, an Irish cookbook, a gluten-free Irish cookbook, because her husband was just diagnosed with celiac disease.
Yes.
And I said, number one, it holds no interest for me.
Mm-hmm.
Perhaps if someone in my family
right.
had it, it would. It's something... It doesn't appeal to me. So it has to be something that I am very passionate about,
mm-hmm.
that I really will enjoy writing about. So
okay.
could I write a book on cheese? Yes. Would I? It's probably would be a little too, you know, too limiting. But I mean, I have to have that kind of interest personally in order to, you know, go forward.
To write a book, to be an author, and you are a celebrated author, indeed, on both sides of the Atlantic, you're well known. Do you draw a distinction between cooking, baking? How can you separate one from the other? Do you have to be a chef? Do you have to have... expertise. You have to be born with the wooden spoon.
No. In fact, people ask me, well, sometimes people refer to me as a chef, and that's the first thing I do is correct them. I'm not a chef. I've never had any training as a chef. I'm first and foremost a writer. I was an English teacher and English and journalism for 32 years.
Okay.
So I think that's my base is writing. And I've always had an interest in cooking and a passion for Ireland. It sounds like a standard line, but that is the way, that is the truth. So when I decided to do something with all of those interests, it just was pretty logical that I could write an Irish cookbook because it handles all three of my interests. So I am not a chef, and I test every recipe. And if I can't cook it in my small kitchen,
right.
then I do not put it in the book.
Is that the secret?
Yeah.
Okay, but also for somebody who, and you do see your cookbooks in many kitchens around, but is simplicity, is that a key, or is that also... Is that one of it? I mean, do you cater to those who want to keep it simple, or are there different grades of writings and books that you have?
There are, definitely. I personally like to keep it simple, but if it's a recipe that someone, a chef, has given me, and again, because I'm not a chef and I'm not
right.
I'm not really a recipe developer, although I can take some ingredients and, you know, conjure up, if you will. It sounds like not a nice word, conjure up. Create a recipe, test it. If it doesn't work, start again. I do like to have recipes that are, you know, simple, that the average home cook could make. But if a chef offers a recipe to me and it is so fantastic and it covers maybe two pages in a cookbook, I mean, it's worth trying. So I don't only have simple recipes. Some of them are a little bit more complicated, but they all have an indigenous Irish ingredient in them, or there's always a connection somehow.
You're not reluctant, though, to take as is from some of the great chefs, and God knows more chefs have come from Ireland that have made a great name for themselves worldwide, and there is actually something about the Irish chef.
Yes.
That, in fact, you will take and give credit to?
Oh, to that chef, always. Always, always.
Okay, so not you. You are not saying that everything that I write I thought of in the middle of the night, or Holy Ghost came down and told
Margaret, use this recipe. No. In fact, the very first cookbook that I ever wrote that was published in Ireland in 1992, which was really quite cutting edge because nobody was writing anything about Irish food, that was my invitation to Irish chefs. I sent them letters, regular letters through the U.S. Postal Service, inviting them to offer a recipe to me that they thought was indicative of, quote, the new Irish cuisine, 1992. And if they were interested in participating, I would be honored to use their recipe with full credit to them and their, if it was a country house, hotel, wherever.
Sure.
And the response was overwhelming. The first eye I got back was from Francis Brennan at the Park Hotel Kenmare. And when he said, my chef would be delighted, I thought, this is it. I'm on my way. And that's how it started, and it's continued. So the head notes to recipes are a very, very important part of the books.
Okay, now, flavors of this book, Flavors of Ireland, it's the Christmas, your Christmas book.
Mm-hmm.
It also takes in the whole festive season.
Exactly.
It's taking in Thanksgiving. It's taking in before and after Christmas. It's kind of a... it's
holiday. Even though it's Christmas. There's no getting away from it. It's not happy holiday. It's Christmas. Yet.
Now... there are those, including myself, who immediately think of Christmas and Ireland and having been bred and buttered in Ireland, excuse the pun, but we think of the Christmas cake. We think of the Christmas pudding, and then that'd nearly do us.
Oh.
What beyond the Christmas cake, and actually let's not dismiss that either, because an Irish Christmas cake is very special.
Mm-hmm.
And there are many, many ethnic groups who I'm sure think that theirs is the best of all. But you actually cover traditions as well. You research your stuff.
I do. And I actually have two desserts chapters, if you will, in that book. One is traditional, so it's the Christmas pudding. The history of, you know, the figgy pudding and how it came to
right.
call that, even though it has no figs in it, that kind of thing. Mincemeat tarts. All the things that you would grow up with, dark fruit cakes, light fruit cakes, a couple of interesting ones, boiled fruit cake, and so on. Then I have the last chapter in the book, which covers more just festive desserts that you might find in Ireland at Christmas time, but that are not the pudding and the ones you think of with the fruitcake and those.
What role does aesthetics play in and presentation of food? Are we good as a nation with that? Are we hung up on it? There are many, particularly when we're talking about baked foods. If you go to a German bakery because mm-hmm. We associate that with with some of the presentation, and of course mm-hmm. the Italian bakery and whatever. Mm-hmm. Would you go to an Irish bakery for something other than the soda bread, the stuff that we instantly associate with that?
Here or in Ireland?
Here.
I don't personally know of that many just exclusive Irish bakeries.
Right.
I mean, I don't live in a neighborhood. I don't live in New York City, so where I live, I certainly don't have them. But I think if you lived in a neighborhood, that had a lot of Irish people in it,
right.
You would certainly go in there, but it would be for your soda breads, your puddings.
Yeah,
The things, especially at Christmas time, those kinds
and
of things.
And the sausages and the fry. Yeah.
Almost like a deli kind of
right.
shop rather than,
How then do you select? One of the things that we've talked about before, and I think we can acknowledge, is that there are some recipes and some dishes that are regional. You might get in Limerick there could be mm-hmm. Traditions of culinary arts that actually don't spread to Clare or to Kerry or to something else
right.
like that. How do you root those out in terms of tradition, or have they become more generic?
Well, again, I'm an Irish American, so never having lived in Ireland to be able to answer that, people ask that of me a lot. Are there specific, like, let's say Italian is like Sicilian food is completely different than food in Northern Italy. I said that's a big country. Ireland is, I think, about the size of the state of Maine.
Mm-hmm.
So there really are, to my knowledge. Not that many true regional specialties. I mean, a few things, like I think of that bread in Waterford, the Blah, I think
yes.
it's BLH.
Yeah.
That's unique, I think, to that town. Maybe we think of Limerick ham and Dublin coddle. But I don't think there are that many that are really that specific. I think they said, too, someone told me, I say they, corned beef in Cork. Is that correct? Corned beef and Cork?
I think corned beef, myself, was a creation.
Definitely.
Here of, I have a suspicion that was something that was created in the Jewish delis of New York to somehow give something to the Irish immigrants who were coming here, and it was not, nobody in Ireland, other than those to this day, who are catering to Yanks, mm-hmm. would call it corned beef in the first place.
Salted beef, I think. And when I mentioned Cork, I think that's actually what I should have said. Because some professor of culinary history,
mm-hmm.
Whose name escapes me at the moment, did do quite a lengthy paper on salted beef and that in Cork in particular. But the corned beef story that you're talking about is, to my knowledge, also completely true, that Irish immigrants were looking for something to resemble bacon and cabbage.
Bacon and cabbage.
And they lived in Jewish neighborhoods, in Boston in particular,
yeah.
New York and Philadelphia, wherever.
And it took off.
It took off because it was salted beef, so it was the same, almost as salted pork.
All right. For the holidays.
Yes.
Obviously, the Christmas cake has great resonance and has... for many of us, the Christmas cake, the one from Ireland, from Irish tradition, I should say, is that's it. I mean, that's that there is something about that Irish Christmas cake that's unique, that is there, and I'm sure many must have, you know, would say, "What the hell are you talking about? We have, you know, it's a fruit cake. It has a lot of ingredients that are not peculiar to the Irish."
No, I think one, again, never having lived in Ireland, but certainly have learned so much about it, is that the ingredients, a lot of the fruits were very expensive, and the spices, and hard to come by in a country that was, by and large, a very poor country. So
And the climate didn't...
And exactly. And so they weren't growing, you know, raisins and figs and things like that. So you save... And probably all of us do, like the best for Christmas. So you would take all those things that you wouldn't enjoy any other time of the year.
Right.
And I think that's the way it
as
all
a treat.
Came in as a treat into that one Christmas cake. And then, of course, you were able to season it with whiskey and or brandy or, you know, something like that. Because it was special. And it was a special time of the year.
You know, speaking of whiskey, and God knows we enough trouble around here without promoting whiskey, but there are some now whiskey liqueurs, which we didn't, you know, we thought of, we had Irish Mist and whatever. But there are, including this one that's about to be launched, it's the Dubliner liqueur, and it's... indeed being promoted by Bord Bia here, the Irish Food Board. Is this something it has a taste and it's going to be, it's not one that you would associate with. Sometimes we think of wine and we think of liqueurs as something that has to do with flavor. You throw a dash in and it won't do any harm. But they more and more, it seems like, you know, now in totally non-Irish restaurants and something, you will see the Bailey's Irish Cream and that they're sneaking into, you know, diners and to foods as well.
Oh, absolutely. I actually wrote one of my cookbooks. It was called Cooking with Irish Spirits.
Yeah.
And every chapter has a recipe that uses, you know, Guinness or whiskey or Bailey's ice cream. And this Dubliner has a lot of caramel and honey overtones.
Yeah.
So it's going to be, I actually tried a cheesecake last night with it.
Yeah.
And when I make it again, I'm going to add more because, you know, alcohol does cook off.
Right.
People are worried sometimes, are like, I don't want to put that in. My children are going to eat it.
Sure.
You know, but if you're braising or something like that, not to worry.
Yeah, not to worry is right. And, you know, how could we have Christmas pudding without wasting a whole pile of, you know, a slew of whiskey or brandy or something because we want to see it all burn off.
But again, it's a special occasion that Christmas is to everyone, to all ethnic groups certainly, but to the Irish, I think it's
your book,
particularly
this one. And if anybody wants to take a look, indeed, at your several books and where you've been going, there's hardly a cookbook that we can associate with Irish that you haven't already covered. You mentioned Irish spirits, and there is other, the Irish pub, the, you know, on Irish puddings, on tarts, pies, and you've written books on, you know, a lot of areas, and they are Irish. I mean, they are. Listen, your own website.
Yes, irishcook.com is the website, but I am offering anyone who's interested in an autographed or especially inscribed copy, maybe as a Christmas gift, they can just email me at irishonecook@aol.com and tell me what they'd like on the book, and I'd be happy to.
Good.
You know.
And you can also log on to Irish Cook, Irish One Cook. AOL.com and get your
order one.
Yeah.
But okay. it's on Amazon.
And on Amazon. And again, well, good luck to you, Anna. You line up new converts each year.
I do.
And we know that when...
Even the naysayers.
Absolutely. Okay. Margaret Johnson. And incidentally, on her book here, there's a foreword by Wade Murphy. Best Shelf Monster, 2012.
Mm-hmm.
Good luck. Again, go to Amazon. Christmas Flavors of Ireland. It's great. And there's something in here, even for the beginners. And it's good.
Thank
Friends, you're listening to Irish Radio Network, USA.